Know thyself. Be true to yourself. Be your authentic self. Be yourself. Promise me I'm never going to find you faking. There's a lot of advice out there from philosophy and psychology and pop music about being authentic, being who we are. But what does it really mean to be authentic? Turns out that's a big question in the world of psychology. Our next guest has new research into what makes us feel authentic in some situations and not in others. He says understanding authenticity can help us understand what to do when something just doesn't feel like us. It doesn't feel right. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does it mean to you to be your authentic self? Is there a time when you feel like you're being authentic self and when you really don't? How do you know when something feels true to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Matt Baldwin is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Florida. His latest piece for The Conversation is titled What the New Science of Authenticity Says About Discovering Your True Self. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob.
In that piece, you talk about how our understanding of authenticity has changed over time. What are some of the older ideas about what being authentic meant?
Yeah, it's a great question. The idea of authenticity is widely varied, but something sort of common in that conception, kind of the older conception of authenticity, is that there's sort of a difference between, you know, this true self that's deep inside of us, something, you know, true and core to who we are, and then something that's more false, something that sort of goes against that true self. And for kind of the older thinkers, being authentic meant sort of finding out who that true self is, getting in touch with that version of the self, and then sort of doing your best to live in accordance with that self, you know, shrugging off external influences, you know, sort of not going along with the flow of society and sort of living out your most intrinsic true self.
And it sounds like you're hinting that that's not really what psychologists think about authenticity anymore. What has changed?
Yeah. So kind of early notions of authenticity in the psychology literature, you know, kind of tried to borrow from this notion. So, you know, we kind of went looking for these characteristics in people, you know, can we find people who are sort of more in touch with their true self than other people? But it became clear pretty quickly that defining the true self was very difficult because, of course, you know, everyone has a different idea of who their true self is. You know, I can't define your true self really any more than you can define your true self. And so building a science of authenticity on that notion was very elusive. And then we sort of also ran into some problems with, you know, what happens if the person you decide that your true self is a bad person or someone that you don't particularly like, you know? Now we have a problem because people like to think that authenticity is a good thing. So it sort of, yeah, led us down a road that created all sorts of problems. So more recently, we've kind of started thinking of authenticity as a feeling, kind of a state that varies a lot from day to day, situation to situation. And, you know, people can sort of pinpoint when they feel like they're being true to themselves. And that's a little bit easier to define because we let people sort of tell us when they have that feeling.
I'll pursue that a little more in a minute. But what about this? What if there's not such a thing as my true self? Well, then forget about authenticity. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to bounce through my day and do what I do.
Yeah, I mean, and some people kind of have that more pessimistic notion that there's not really a self at all. And so what we should do is sort of more pursue, you know, sort of in the moment, things that might make us happier, that, you know, give us a rich experience and not worry too much about the self. The answer to that that's maybe a little bit more optimistic is that, you know, there may not be a real entity or thing that is the self, but surely we all have a self-concept, right? Like we all have an idea of who we are that may or may not track with anything. And this concept of who we are can actually be a pretty good guide to, you know, the things that we find important. It might be a guide to living in a way that sort of allows us to cooperate with other people and kind of live up to some moral ideals in society. And some people have kind of considered authenticity or the true self as a guide. And in that way, you know, the true self becomes sort of whatever we decide it is. Again, that's hard to study because everyone's concept of who they are is wildly different from everyone else's. And so We're sort of more interested in what people feel like when they pursue this thing that is their true self concept.
We're talking to Matt Baldwin, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Florida. He's with us today to talk about his new research into what makes us feel authentic, like we're being true to ourselves. Sometimes easier said than done. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Think about moments in your life, things that you're doing, people you're with, where you think, yeah, this is me. I feel like I'm being true to myself. And the opposite, times in your life where you feel like I'm faking it, hopefully till I make it. How do you steer from one to the other? What questions do you have about the psychology of authenticity? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're talking about new research on authenticity, what it means to feel like you're being your true self, what's going on when you feel that way and when you don't. Matt Baldwin from the University of Florida stays with us. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences when you do and don't feel authentic, when you do and don't feel like I'm me right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Matt, let's get into your research now. What is it that determines, when we're doing something, if we feel authentic right now, we feel inauthentic right now?
Yeah, great question. So we sort of built on this idea that people feel authentic when they sort of match their surroundings. So some really recent research suggests that people feel the most authentic when their goals or their beliefs or their self-concepts seem to fit to their surroundings, right? If you think you're a very artistic person, then you feel most authentic when you're surrounded by art things, creative people, and so on. But we wanted to know if there were feelings of authenticity that even go beyond this match between who someone thinks they are and their surroundings. And so we built on some research on the feeling of fluency. And fluency is the feeling that you get when your experiences feel easy, feel natural, when things just kind of are without conflict. And we thought that maybe people experience this feeling of fluency and interpret that feeling that whatever they're doing in the moment must represent who they are. So it's sort of a lay theory about those feelings of fluency and how it might relate to who they are. So we wanted to study whether when people feel this fluent feeling, are they also feeling authentic in the moment?
And are they?
Well, the results are a little bit mixed, but we're sort of getting an idea that that's the case. So, for example, in one study, we asked people to write down the last activity they did, and then to tell us using some rating scales, how fluent it felt, how natural it felt to them, and also whether they felt authentic while they were doing it. And people listed all kinds of things, from brushing their teeth to making coffee to having a work meeting. And to the extent that people felt like those activities were easy and natural and fluent, that predicted or correlated with how authentic they felt in the moment. So that's one piece of evidence. We also used an experiment to test this idea, and we made it more or less difficult for people to come up with attributes or characteristics that describe who they are. And when people felt this disfluency or this difficulty coming up with ideas about who they are, they also reported feeling less authentic in the moment. And of course, this had nothing to do with their self-concepts or being true to any kind of, real concrete self. We simply just made it difficult to do this. And these difficult feelings, people interpreted or translated into feeling inauthentic in the moment.
Okay, but I think a lot of people might say, I'm my true self by challenging myself sometimes, trying something new, stepping outside of my comfort zone. How do you see that fitting in?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So there's also some research suggesting that people have sort of different ideas on what difficulty or ease means to them. So some people think that difficulty or challenge means that it's important to be doing that thing. So, it's nothing is worth doing unless it's challenging, And there's even some recent research showing that people actually gain a lot from seeking discomfort. We grow a lot from these experiences. So I would say that the feelings of fluency that people experience can be sort of one source of authenticity. But, you know, as those feelings emerge, people might think about them, they might interpret them, they might look around at their surroundings, and those feelings could be overridden by other thoughts or other values or other things going on. You know, so sometimes difficulty might mean, you know, this is what I have to go through to really find my true self. I would say that eventually difficult situations become easy and fluent, right? So there may be an initial period of difficulty, but in the end, people assume, well, I've now reached a point where doing this thing is easy and natural and flowy, and this is evidence that it was right all along, that I've become kind of my true self now.
We heard from Reed in Whitewater, who couldn't stay on the line. Reed wonders, can ourselves really just be boiled down to our likes and dislikes? What do you think?
Ooh, that's a really great question. Yeah, I mean, I think that our likes and dislikes are like, you know, magnets that push and pull us toward the things that might eventually signal, you know, kind of who we are. There's some research in self-perception theory, for example, that suggests that, yeah, we sort of use our everyday experiences to infer something about who we are. So I think, you know, at a very basic level, yeah, sure, I think our likes and dislikes make up a large part of our self-concepts, and we pursue those things to find who we are.
Can you leave us with some thoughts on, you know, if somebody feels like I'm often feeling like I'm not being my true self, I feel inauthentic for one reason or another, does the research point to some steps they might take to find at least more moments of feeling authentic?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually a great question. I'm not sure if there's any research that kind of gives the antidote to inauthenticity. You know, but I would just suggest people kind of consider the source of those feelings, right? So sometimes we might feel inauthentic or feel conflict in these feelings of inauthenticity that may have to do with something like, I don't know, social comparison, right? We feel we're out of touch or out of place because we're comparing to people who maybe are better than us or, you know, outside of our social groups or something like that. And maybe that's an inaccurate comparison standard. So sometimes, you know, maybe those feelings are coming from an invalid source and we might want to check those feelings. But other times we might recognize that, hey, you know, this conflict means that the experience I'm having right now, whether it be at work or in a relationship, you know, it means that I'm not aligned in my goals or my values or my beliefs. So I think the information we get from those feelings can help us make decisions. And it's important, you know, to take that information, those feelings, and sort of check it with reality and sort of decide, you know, is this a valid feeling? Is this a valid source of information? Or is it something that I should, you know, put aside?
Matt, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Matt Baldwin, assistant professor of psychology at the University of Florida. He was with us today to talk about his new research into authenticity and what goes into feeling like our true selves. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The Walt Disney Company is pushing back on a controversial Florida law about education related to gender issues in schools. It's officially called the Parental Rights in Education Law. Critics have called it the Don't Say Gay Bill. In response to Disney's pushback, Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis pushed for and signed a law on Friday that would end Disney's status as a special tax district in the state that would start in June of 2023.
And incredibly, they say, we are going to work to repeal parents' rights in Florida. And I'm just thinking to myself, you're a corporation based in Burbank, California. And you're going to marshal your economic might to attack the parents of my state? We view that as a provocation, and we are going to fight back against that.
Disney has not yet publicly commented on the state's actions against them. The company could contest the move in court. We're learning more about the conflict between Disney and the Florida state government. For a look at how corporations balance political, financial, and social interests, David Primo is the Ani and Mark Gabrielian Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's great to be back with you.
Well, I gave a whirlwind tour. There's a lot going on here, David. Yeah. First of all, how unusual is this public battle in some ways between a state government and a big employer in that state?
I think what's dramatic here is how rapidly the state government in Florida responded to the actions of the Disney company. But in recent years, it has become increasingly common for corporations to become enmeshed in social and political battles that at one point in history, they really never would have gotten in the middle of. And in many respects, it's because they're being pushed into these issues in ways that they haven't been in the past. Let me just provide a context. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's an irony here in that corporations, or this issue about corporations being involved in the political process, part of the reason they're being drawn in is that there are that we've seen, of course, increased political polarization around the country. And that polarization is leading employees, consumers, activists to push corporations to take positions on things like police brutality or issues related to LGBTQ rights. The irony, though, is that Americans are polarized about whether corporations ought to be doing this. So if you look at the average press coverage or media coverage of this issue, the belief is that Americans widely support corporations getting in the middle of political issues. But the reality is that, in general, Democrats are highly supportive of this, and Republicans are not. And so there's actually a divide over that, even whether or not corporations ought to be getting involved in the political process. So there are a lot of layers here we need to peel back.
Right. Corporations have been involved in the political process in a lot of ways, more in ways that reflects their direct interests. Like Disney has lobbied a time or two on copyright law, for example.
Right.
Do you see a big distinction between I'm a business, I'm going to lobby based on, something that's going to affect my bottom line directly versus I'm going to make a statement because I believe it's going to affect my bottom line because of consumer perception?
It's pretty straightforward to think that a corporation ought to be taking positions on issues related to its core business operations. And in fact, Americans, generally speaking, broadly support that. What's changed in recent years is that now executives and some voters believe that corporations ought to be taking positions on issues unrelated to their core business. So in a poll in 2021, which I think is very striking, 63% of the corporate executives that were surveyed believed that corporations ought to be taking positions on issues unrelated to their core business. That's in contrast with only 36% of Americans in total who believe that that was the case. So corporate executives are actually much more activist in some sense than Americans on average. Now, of course, there is that polarization I just talked about. But I think there's a risk for executives here. And I think it's a risk that's not being discussed too much in the news. It seems obvious, right, that corporations, to many people, that corporations ought to be taking stands on issues like police brutality or LGBTQ rights. But the challenge for an executive who has to be concerned who has a fiduciary responsibility to the company is, at what point do you draw the line? Because once you start taking positions on issues unrelated to your core business, you basically become a political operation where you have to take positions on everything, because on any issue, you're going to have some consumers of your product who are going to push you to take a position. And there's another piece to this, which is, by definition, right, these are contentious social issues. There's profound disagreement about the Don't Say Gay bill. There's profound disagreement about issues like voting rights bills in Georgia that received a lot of controversy, or abortion bills in Texas that received a lot of controversy. So if you as a company stake out a position, you are just as likely to alienate a significant portion of your consumer base as you are to gain the support of a significant part of your consumer base.
Another part of the story here is the response from Governor DeSantis and the legislature in Florida saying, okay, Disney, you have this special tax status, which I didn't know about. That's another weird story that we could spend a whole hour on probably. But saying, okay, I mean, some of them flat out said it pretty much, because you're taking the stance against this bill we passed, we're going to come at that special tax status. And some legal experts have said, well, wait a minute, you're punishing parties for political speech. How do you sort that out?
I'm not gonna take a strong position on the legal ramifications of this because I'd have to look into it a little bit more. But I think I want to put this into a little bit of context in terms of the honestly the hypocrisy on both the left and the right on this issue. So for many years, the left has been saying in the wake of the 2010 Citizens United decision that corporations need to stay out of politics. They're spending too much money on politics. This decision was terrible for the country. But now, of course, the left is calling for corporations to take strong stands on LGBTQ rights and so on. On the other side, the right had defended the rights of corporations to be involved in the political process, and now they're engaging in what can best be described, right, as retaliatory tactics for that same political engagement. And this highlights a general tension within all of us, where we might support speech rights in the abstract, but in reality, we often our answers about whether or not we support speech rights are often contingent on who's doing the speaking. So in some research I've done, Americans, when asked about whether or not they'd support the speech rights of Ben and Jerry's, answered differently than when asked whether they'd support the speech rights of ExxonMobil based on their ideology. And so there's an example, right, of how there's really honestly hypocrisy on both sides of this issue. So it is easy to pick on the state of Florida for their actions, and I do think it is concerning to retaliate against a company on the basis of its on an unrelated issue on the basis of its political speech. But on the other hand, those on the left have been doing this for quite a while as well, just perhaps not as dramatically.
Right. What kind of examples of retaliation would you point toward from the left in the past?
Well, on the left, you've seen examples, for instance, where if a corporation has taken a position when President Biden took office, right, he basically issued an executive order that, by all accounts, waged war on tech companies, basically saying, you know, we're concerned about tech companies. They're too powerful and we're going to. We're going to crack down on them. When President Obama took office, he basically said, we're going to wage war on oil companies because we're concerned about their environmental record. And there have been attempts by the left, for 30, 40 years to use the law, specifically campaign finance law, to restrict the speech rights of corporations. I'm not sure I would necessarily use the word retaliation there, but on the left, there have certainly been attempts to literally silence the voices of corporations in the political process. Or because an industry was disfavored by those on the left, there's a belief that sort of we can write an executive order and say we're going to go after all tech companies. I think the right has been a little bit more aggressive in terms of specifically targeting individual companies. So President Trump did this as well. But the left has sort of preferred a more broad-based approach where they go after entire industries or just corporations in general. And I'm thinking here specifically about the campaign finance issue. Different tactics, same outcome.
Talking to David Primo from the University of Rochester, professor of political science and business administration. We're talking about the overlap of political science and business administration right now with the conflict between Disney and the state of Florida, the state government of Florida, over a new law there. David, if a CEO came to you and said, you know, I don't know, I'm not sure there's a lot of consumer pressure from both sides on what I should and shouldn't say, what would you suggest to them before dipping their toes in the water of expressing their company's views on social issues?
I think the key is to be prepared. So, we've seen this since the Black Lives Matter and the police brutality issues came up a few years back, that companies were woefully unprepared for this rise in calls for what's called brand activism. So I think the first step is to make a plan and to set a clear set of guidelines about what issues you are going to take positions on and what issues you're not going to take positions on and make it public. Let people know that we have a responsibility to our shareholders. We have responsibility to our customers and our employees, but we cannot be all things to all people. And so we are going to be very clear about, right, what issues we are going to be involved in and what issues we are not going to be involved in. And only by doing that can you then have something to fall back on when you feel the pressure to take a stand. And I would also advise corporations take a deep breath, that unfortunately in the era of a 24-hour news cycle, there's a temptation to just say something right away. Instead, take a minute, think about what position you want to take, and also consider the downsides to any position you take. In other words, on a contentious issue, you're going to potentially alienate a good chunk of your customer base if you are aggressive in your brand activism. So, you know, now in the case of Disney, I'm not sure how they could have necessarily handled this better, in the sense they were getting pressure from their employees, they're getting pressure from activists to take a strong stand on this. But what they could have done is not flip-flopped. It was the flip-flopping, I think, that created a perfect storm for what we've ended up seeing happening. It would have been much better had they thought carefully about their initial response and not been perceived as kind of, you know, sticking their finger into the, you know, seeing which way the wind was blowing, basically. And again, this is, you know, as I say to my students, these are executives who get paid millions of dollars per year. They have to be able to navigate these political waters, but for many of them, they view it as a distraction. But as you can see, this is something that can have huge consequences for a company if they don't pay close attention to it.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's David Primo, the Ani and Mark Cabrillion Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester in New York, with us today exploring how corporations navigate political issues as Disney and Florida clash over the state's parental rights and education bill, also called the Don't Say Gay Law by critics.